station number 7175, reel 4.
Sir Alexander Stanier, Reel 4. I think that after the seizure of St. Vaast, you were then probing forward again, following up the retreating enemy.
That's
and
right.
Where did you come up against them?
And we came up against them. They were holding the high ground beyond the River Sel. And in strength. It was therefore decided to put in a brigade attack by night. During the day, sappers came up and taped out the ground down to the river itself under cover of fire and as close as they could get, and bridges were made of petrol cans lashed together with ropes. At midnight, the most spectacular barrage I've ever seen opened up. It was pouring with rain, very dark, and suddenly this terrific bombardment came down on the Germans, and we advanced. I came up the hill in the leading company on our front, finding great difficulty in finding my way because it was so dark, the rain, there was barbed wire all over the place and everything else. But eventually, with great difficulty in getting other people out of the way and directing ourselves, my company commander got his company up onto the top of the ridge. It was then just about getting light, and a message came to say, send out a patrol at once and find out if the next river, the Harpies, was held by the Germans. So immediately I collected about six men and a corporal and told them to follow me. There was no time to give any further instructions. Because I knew that what I'd got to do myself. We walked down the sloping hillside, which was quite bare of stubble, and came to a little hedge, which I left the platoon behind, and I and my servant went on across the meadow, I suppose about 200 or 300 yards. As we approached the river, I saw a German with a machine gun between his legs, asleep, and a German NCO, I imagine, shaking him up and pointing at me, whereupon he let off the machine gun, but of course it wasn't properly aimed and the bullets went over my head. My servant and I then jumped into the river so that he couldn't see us and waded up the stream until we came to a little ditch which ran into the river. We crawled up that and got back about 100 yards or so from the hedge. By this time, the Germans had started firing, having been woken up by the other man, and the patrol found that they couldn't see to fire behind the hedge, so they had to move out into the open before they could fire, whereupon some of them got shot for their trouble. After a time, I decided I must just run across to them, which I did, thinking that my servant would see me and follow me, but he didn't see me and stayed in the brook. I got behind the hedge, and all went quiet, and we saw some of the Germans withdrawing up the hillside. So I fanned them out and started going up the hill. We got about halfway up the hill back to the company when the Germans opened up, and the members of the patrol were all hit, including the corporal in the arm, who fell on the top of me into a very small shell hole. The Germans went on firing, put one through the rim of my tin hat, which was rather too close for my liking. But anyhow, we lay there, and at about 12 o'clock, it seemed to go quiet, and some gallant stretcher bearers came out, and the Germans must have withdrawn, and they picked up the wounded and brought them back and took them down to battalion headquarters. One of the guardsmen was asked by the adjutant, "Where's the officer?" To which the guardsman said, "He's been very badly wounded in the upper leg, and he's covered in blood, and he's so badly hit he can't walk, and we've had to leave him behind at the company headquarters." So the adjutant said, "Thank you very much," filled in the casualty report that had to go in at 12 o'clock, saying one officer seriously wounded upper leg. Actually, what had happened was the Corporal Garn's arm had bled on the top of my Macintosh, which I was still wearing, and of course it made the most awful mess on me. But other than being hit in the hand, I was all right and remained at duty. Next day, that night we were relieved. I reported to the adjutant and said, I think I'm due for leave in England. He said, "Good God, I thought you were there already. I've reported it. You being seriously wounded, I thought you were home already." Anyhow, I came on leave and was there for November the 11th when the armistice was signed. So when I returned, all was quiet.
Can I ask you a little bit more about this brigade attack at night and then your subsequent patrol? You say there was a spectacular bombardment, presumably against the far side of the river you had to cross. Did the Germans shell you as you were forming up and moving down towards the river?
Very little. But they opened up with machine guns quite a lot.
So they weren't entirely suppressed?
Oh, no. No, but they were pretty shaken.
How far did you actually have to advance before you got to the river? What was the distance down these tapes to the bank of the river?
Well, I think about 1,000 yards.
And have you any idea how long it took you to cover that distance?
No, I don't think I could even guess. It was pouring with rain, it was very slippery and muddy, and there weren't any particular tracks. One was thankful when one got to the tape that man said, "This is number 6 platoon," or whatever it was, and you'd arrive at the right place.
Had you done any training in night fighting?
No. I don't remember Sandhurst really doing anything very much, nor very much in England. We did have one or two nights out in Richmond Park. That was all.
How did the conduct of an attack at night differ from a similar sort of operation in daytime?
Much more difficult to find your way. Because, as I say, I had my compass, but it seemed to be whizzing round with all the tin steel about. And so many people were in the wrong place. People from the flanks had moved in and across, and there was a terrible lot of shouting and cursing of people being in the wrong place.
Did you use different sort of formation for night work?
I remember everybody shouting, "Close up, keep close together." And yes, we tried to keep as close as we could.
Did you actually keep your sections in physical contact, for instance?
Yeah, very much so, yes.
Because one way in which it's done, if it's very dark, is for for them to have hold of each other's clothing.
Well, we did, yeah. We had to go in single file across the little bridges and then halted on the far side, waiting for them to come. And when the last man had come, we started up. And going up the bank, we did as much as we could. As we went up the bank, of course, we captured a certain number of Germans, including an anti-tank rifle, which we'd never seen before.
Were the Germans occupying field works, or were they just lying in the open, in this position?
Small trenches. Nothing continuous, just what they'd had time to dig.
So there were scrapes, really?
Scrapes, yeah.
Did the Germans actually fight hard once you came in and amongst them?
No. No, I think they. Certainly the ones where I captured the anti-tank rifle put up their hand straight away directly they saw us.
So your appearance in strength was enough to give up?
The war was coming to an end, and they knew it.
Did you get the impression during this last month or so that the Germans were getting to a state of resignation, that they were resigned to defeat and they just wanted to get it over with?
No, I don't think we did. No, they were very tough right to the end. But I think once they saw it was up, they would surrender quicker perhaps than before. But they were still ready to fire, and they were brave men.
When you went forward on your reconnaissance patrol, your six men, you said you saw a German who was asleep behind his machine gun. What sort of machine gun was it? Was it a...
It was on a tripod.
So it was a medium machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And was that in any sort of prepared position, or was it just...
No, he was just in a little copse, and sort of bushes round him. Obviously nothing in front of him, because it was very low on the ground.
So he was on the forward edge of the...
He was right on the edge of the river, but he had bushes all round him. And he had a sort of Macintosh cape sort of thing on, I think, as far as I can see, and this big man shaking him on the top.
And you said you leapt into the river and waded up the river. Did this man continue shooting at you once you got into the water?
No, because he then started shooting at the rest of the patrol who were behind the hedge and had come out into the open, because they couldn't shoot from where I'd left them. I ought to have put them in a fire position before I left. I forgot about that.
But presumably you didn't know where the enemy were anyway, because you were looking for them.
Exactly. So. But I think I ought to have left them in a fire position.
And you said that most of the patrol were actually hit. Presumably they were hit by small arms fire rather than anything larger on that occasion.
Yes, they were shot in the legs, most of them. I think the machine gun sort of swept the bank like that. And in some way, the range just caught... Well, there were, six or seven of them.
It also seems that you were more or less cut off, or that you got into the enemy positions in your movement forward, because you're saying, I think, that you got shot at from several sides at once, not just from this particular machine gun.
That's right.
Did the Germans make any sort of counterattack, or do you think you've just got into their area?
No, they just didn't want us to cross the river.
What happened to your casualties? Did they all survive, or...?
Yes. My servant, who was Private Lakin, wrote to me on the 28th of October, saying, "I'm in hospital at East Leeds War Hospital, and this is just a line to let you know I've arrived in Blighty as per above address. I'm pleased to say I'm going on well. I'm hit in the head, shoulder, back, leg and arm, quite a few, but I'm still smiling. There is one consolation I have, that is I am well out of reach of those whistling machine gun bullets. I met Corporal Garn from the patrol at CCS, but have not seen him since. I did not notice you go from that brook where we were lying in, so I decided to hang on a bit. The suspense began to get on my nerves. Not knowing whether Fritz was not working up those bushes, I decided to run the gauntlet. I started. I managed to clear the brook and field and got past the hedge when one of our own shells caught me in the back and shoulder. Down I fell. Then Fritz contributed one through my arm and one through my leg. Thinking I had not had enough, he loaned me another in the head. After this quite exciting period, here I am, happy at the prospect of being once again in Blighty. I'm quite well at present, despite my wounds, and hope my letter finds you in the very best of health. I must close now, wishing the battalion the very best of luck. I remain your obedient servant, W. H. Lakin. Marvellous letter.
And presumably he was still in hospital when the armistice came.
Yes. I've seen him since. He's dead now. But I've seen him since.
When he went on patrol, was his duty to act as your sort of bodyguard and general reminder?
Yeah.
So he's really more than a servant.
Oh, yes. Orderly. Runner.
I think you went on leave to England after this patrol. How long were you away?
A fortnight altogether.
And then you went back to France?
France.
And rejoined the battalion?
The battalion, who had moved, had marched from, they'd captured Maubeuge, was the last place they got into. And from there, I caught them up at Charleroi. And we marched from Charleroi to Cologne.
This was after the Germans had given up.
Oh, yes. Oh, the 11th of November, I was in England.
So from Charleroi, on your march into Cologne, it was an unopposed route march.
Oh, yes. But very bad conditions, because the roads were so terribly broken up by the retreating German transport. And anyhow, they were only gravel.
What about the railways? What sort of condition were they in?
They were so broken up where the trenches had been around Ypres and Arras and Amiens that it was taking them a long time to repair them, and very few trains were able to get through.
So you were just on foot across difficult routes?
Yes, straight over the Ardennes down to the Rhine.
Did the logistics services managed to keep up with you on this march into Germany?
Marvellously, really. I don't know how they did it. You saw these very old lorries bouncing along. And of course we had all our horse transport. We had no cars or anything.
So you never went short of anything essential?
No. And every man carried his full equipment, and everybody who left Maubeuge arrived in Cologne.
You didn't lose anybody through poor feet or anything like that?
No,
in a way.
No.
And what was your first impression of Germany once you'd crossed the frontier into the enemy's territory?
Very submissive. Very correct. Very subdued. But still trying to carry on as usual. Battalion headquarters was billeted in a big castle near Cologne, and they were expecting a house party at the same time of relations, and they just sort of carried on as usual.
They didn't show any signs of hostility?
No. They turned out in the streets, and when the colours came out from England, they all doffed their hats. Very few had to be told to take your hat off as they passed. They were most correct.
Did you have any conversations with German civilians about the war and the way it had gone?
No. I don't think I did. We weren't supposed to fraternize with them, and I think we rather felt that we didn't wish to. We went into the shops and bought things. There weren't many things to buy, but we bought little souvenirs.
Did the population seem to be in reasonable condition?
They looked very white. All their faces looked very white. No, they looked tense. They were all right, but...
You didn't see any signs of malnutrition, for
instance? Well, they were, yes.
Or disease.
To a certain extent. But not too bad.
What about the German army? Did you see much of them?
No, nothing at all. I got photographs of them. They were hailed as great heroes, not as victors, but as heroes, and flowers were thrown to them by the population before we came to wear in their buttonholes as they crossed the Rhine into Germany.
But they'd gone beyond Cologne by
Time we got there, they were all dead.
And you didn't go beyond Cologne yourselves?
Oh, just the bridgehead. I think we went about 10 miles into Germany, the other side of the bridge, fanned out.
Why do you think it was that you didn't go further into Germany from Cologne?
Because I think it was impossible from the logistic point of view and the state of the troops. There was no transport to carry them. There were no trains to carry them. It was just not possible for them to march there. It's too far.
You say their condition. Were they exhausted by their march to Cologne?
No, but they wouldn't want to. They couldn't have marched much further. I mean, with proper rest, yes, I suppose you could.
How many miles a day would you do when you were on a route march, roughly speaking?
Up, well, not for, well, some up to 20 miles one day we did, but usually I think it was about 14. We marched early in the morning till sort of lunchtime, and then had dinners and bivouacked for the night early in the afternoon. But of course it was winter, and so it got dark very early.
And it would get light late too in the morning.
Yeah.
So you would start off and do about 6 hours marching, presumably, and then you would stop and do all the personal administration and feeding and all the rest of it.
That's right. So you couldn't do more than about 18 miles anyhow. And I should think we averaged about 14.
I can now move on to the Second World War. I'd like to ask you when you took command of the 2nd Battalion of the Welsh Guards.
I took command of the 2nd Battalion of the Welsh Guards the end of May 1939 on its formation. During the summer, we remained at Chelsea Barracks. Reservists came and trained in the Bren gun. They many of them only having learnt the Lewis gun of the First War. When war declared, we were at the Tower of London, and I was informed that I should remain in London and be as the general reserve. On no account would I be sent to France. If there was heavy bombing in London, we would cordon off areas to stop any kind of looting, etc.
So your role was to be one of internal security?
Exactly. And to do the public duties, which was very heavy because it meant guarding Buckingham Palace, the Tower, the Bank, and so on. Early in 1940, I was suddenly told, get ready to go to Norway. I had to explain that I'd not drawn even my mobilization equipment because they didn't want me to wear it out on training. And my training was at a very low standard owing to all the other duties. That was cancelled, and I was told to draw my equipment, mobilization equipment, and proceed to Camberley. to go into camp, which we did. And a brigade was formed, the 2nd Battalion Irish Guards and another line regiment.
I think that was the Loyal Regiment, the North Lancashires.
That's right, I think it was.
How easily did the reservists who were recalled fit back into military life?
Really very well, as long as they were being taught new weapons like 2-inch mortar, Bren gun, anti-tank guns, etc. But they got a bit fed up when they had to go and do public duties and stand about outside the Tower of London and so on.
So they didn't like public duty?
No, they wanted to get on to the war.
If I can ask you a bit about your wider view of what was going on, had you personally seen the war coming?
Yes, but I hoped and particularly that I felt that something would happen, that it wouldn't happen. I thought that Hitler's bluff would be called, my heart of hearts. I used to have terrific arguments. I was second in command of the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards up till I got command of the 2nd. I used to have terrific arguments with my commanding officer, who was quite sure that the war was coming. I used to take the other side. But
so it came as a surprise to you when it did.
Well, towards the last month, I knew that I felt that it was no. When I saw bits of paper being torn up, it was no good. No, and also that I felt we ought to have done more about getting prepared for it. I think if we'd prepared in 1938-39 more than we did, in just raising 2 extra battalions. That didn't frighten Hitler in the slightest, although it was supposed to be a great gesture of defiance.
Did you have any idea about what sort of strategy or tactics the Germans might use in the event of a war against Britain and France?
Yes. I think we rather thought that they'd go back a lot to the First War. There'd be the rush forward by the Germans. We'd hold them. Then trench warfare would come about as it was. We did realise that there'd be much more bombing from the air. In fact, we thought that it'd be much greater than it was to start off with. And I think, of course, the civilians were quite convinced that we were going to have gas. So everybody had gas masks. But the gas and bombing, all the children were evacuated in the towns and all that sort of thing. But I myself was not so concerned about that. I felt that the Germans were going to rush forward, be halted, and we'd be able to make a peace.
What did you think about gas? Did you think there was a serious possibility of its use?
No, not frightfully, because having experienced it in the First War, and that's why I choke a little bit now, because I was gassed. Both sides suffered from it. I mean, the Germans had the advantage they used it first. But once we overcame it and we had a proper gas mask, we gave them just as much hell as they gave us, and said we neutralised it.
So you didn't think it was a war-winning weapon, then?
No.